Today, we are diving into an interesting and, I think, very important topic. The recent expedition led by astrophysicist Avi Loeb, which happens to be our guest tonight. The expedition retrieved metallic spheres from the Pacific Ocean near Papua New Guinea, exhibiting a unique composition labeled, oh my God, Bilau? Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
Yeah, let's talk about that later. These findings hint an interstellar origin, and they are challenging our understanding of celestial objects. And tonight we want to explore the details of this discovery and its potential implications with Avi Loeb himself. So welcome, Avi. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
So before we go deep into all this, a few words to all your listeners out there. If you have no idea what we are talking about right now, please follow the link in the description that leads you to a previous episode with Avi that explains more about the beginning of Avi's expedition and chase for these awesome little spherules. So with that out of the way, let me start with five of these spherules exhibited a unique composition labeled, like I said, Bilau, containing high abundances of beryllium, lanthanum, and uranium. This composition suggests an interstellar origin with iron isotope ratios different from those found in our solar system. Now, I have seen and read a lot of content on the internet now that says that Avi Loeb has found alien material, artificial manufactured alien material, and so on and so on. So please, Avi, fill us in where some people went wrong with that and let us know what this composition of elements really means.
Yeah, so let me start from the beginning. About a decade ago, on January 8th, 2014, the US government satellites spotted a fireball as a result of an object that collided with Earth and burnt up in the lower atmosphere. That object was roughly half a meter in size, released a few percent of the Hiroshima atomic energy output. And the location of the fireball was about 90 kilometers away from Manus Island in Papua New Guinea over the Pacific Ocean. And based on the velocity measurement of the object, one could infer that it's not bound to the sun. It's not gravitationally bound. It's moving too fast, and it came from outside the solar system. It also had the material strength that was tougher than even iron meteorites, because it exploded, it disintegrated only when the stress on it was far greater than that on any other rock that we have seen before from the solar system. And outside the solar system, it was moving faster than 95% of the stars. So that raised an interesting question. What is it? Clearly, it seems to be made of materials different than in the solar system. And also, the fact that it was moving so fast is difficult to explain. It was moving at 60 kilometers per second relative to the local standard of rest of the Milky Way galaxy. That's the local frame of reference. And stars move at typically 30 kilometers per second. So the question is, how can you eject an object from a planetary system like ours? If it comes from the inner part, it has to be inside the Earth's orbit, because the Earth moves around the sun only at 30 kilometers per second. So it's difficult to imagine a rock that is orbiting so close to the star and somehow ejects rocks. And so the question is, what was the origin of this object? And of course, that raises the possibility that it may have been a Voyager, like a meteor, an object that was produced artificially and has an unusual material strength, unusual speed. And to find out, we went to that location, which was localized by the Department of Defense to within about 10 kilometers. So we also managed to localize it even better using data from a seismometer in Papua New Guinea. And so I led an expedition. We collected the 850 molten droplets from that region of 10 kilometers by 10 kilometers around the meteor explosion site. And we brought them back to two laboratories, one at Harvard University, led by my colleague, Professor Stein Jacobson, who is a world-renowned geochemist and has the best mass spectrometer in the world, the best electron microprobe, electron microscope that analyzes the spherules, can give us images. And also we shared it with the laboratory of Dr. Roald Tagel at the Bruker Corporation in Berlin, Germany. And based on 8 months of analysis, so we came back, the expedition was in June 2023. And then since we came back at the end of June, it took 8 months to do the analysis of all the spherules. And the bottom line is that we find that about 10% of them, about 80 or so spherules, have a composition that was never reported before for solar system materials. And that includes enhancements by up to a factor of 1,000 relative to the abundance of elements that you find in the early material that made the solar system. And those elements that are enhanced, as you mentioned, include the beryllium, lanthanum, uranium, and many other rare elements. We analyzed 60 of them. And we call it BELAU because it's enhanced in beryllium, lanthanum, and uranium. And the question is then, what could be the origin of such an unusual composition? I mean, it's not found in the on Earth, in the Earth's crust. It's not found on the Moon, Mars, or asteroids. And we suggest that a possible natural origin would be a planet that has a magma ocean, basically molten rock on its surface. And then if it's for a long enough time, then some elements get attracted to the core of the planet where there is iron, because they have affinity to iron. And those elements are the ones that we find them missing, that have lower abundance in the BELAU spherules. And the ones that are left behind stay in the crust of the planet. And those are the ones that we find enhanced. The question is, how do you get them ejected in a rock at a speed of 60 kilometers per second into interstellar space? And on that, I wrote a paper that provides a possible explanation. The most abundant population of stars have a tenth of the mass of the sun. They are much less massive than the sun, 10 times less massive. And they are also 10 times smaller. And so you pack a tenth of the mass of the sun in a region that is 10 times smaller, you end up with a density that is 100 times bigger than the density of the sun. And it's bigger than the density of rock. So when you take a planet like the Earth and bring it close to such a dwarf star, which is the most common type of star in the Milky Way galaxy, it would rip the planet apart by the tidal force. We know about the tides that raise the level of the ocean, excited by the moon. But if you take a planet like the Earth and put it next to a dwarf star, it would actually spaghettify the planet, make a stream of rocks out of it. And it turns out that half of the mass of the planet would be ejected to interstellar space. And guess what? At the speed of about 60 kilometers per second, if you do the calculation. So it could well be that this is the process that makes interstellar rocks. But we don't know if the object was a rock or a technological gadget. And to find out, we are planning the next expedition to look for bigger pieces. And I should say we published two papers, two research notes on the findings. And we have a very extended paper that we just completed a week ago, submitted for publication. And so we provide all the results, which are really unprecedented. I've never seen a paper of an ocean expedition that reports about so many spherules. Usually the reports are about 10 times less. And also, the results that we found are quite unusual. And so it may be the first time that humans put their hands on materials from a big object that came from outside the solar system, which would be historic, you know, irrespective of whether it's natural or artificial, because, you know, it's just the first time. And the fundamental question is, among all the rocks that we might find, is there any Voyager-like meteor that we might find? And that's why we're also planning to go to the location of the second interstellar meteor that, that we know of, that US government satellites identified. So it's very exciting, I should say.
It is exciting indeed. Yeah, very exciting. How did you feel when you had these little spherules in your hand?
Yeah, so for the first 6 days, we were at sea for 2 weeks. And in the first day, we couldn't keep the sled with the magnets that collected the particles. It was difficult to keep it on the ocean floor because the cable connecting it to the ship was lifting it. It was kiting. And eventually we got it on the floor after a day. And then for five more days, all we saw is volcanic ash that we collected. It was not clear to us that we are finding anything other than volcanic activity, geological activity on Earth. Then on the evening of the sixth day, we decided to filter out the volcanic ash and see if there are any bigger particles left that we can look at with a microscope. And I remember the geologist on the team running down the stairs to call me because I was the chief scientist on the ship. And he was telling me, we found a spherule. And I ran up the stairs and there it was through the microscope image. It was very distinct from the background of sand that we found. And I basically hugged the person who found it because I said, look, this is what we were looking for. And it's amazing. We now found it. And I knew that just like in the kitchen, when you find an ant, you know that there are many more ants out there. And sure enough, we found 50 of them on the ship. And then an intern, a summer intern, after I brought the materials back to Harvard, Sophie Bergstrom, that came to shadow me, she wanted to become a science journalist, asked me if she can help with the science. I said, sure, and gave her a pair of tweezers and a microscope. And within a week, she found 600 of them in the materials and increased the sample by a factor of 10. And I then gave her the title, The Spheral Hunter. And her success now convinced her that she would like to pursue a career in science, not science journalism. And so I feel very happy about that.
Awesome. As a scientist involved in this historic interstellar expedition, how do you view the role of exploration in expanding not only our scientific knowledge, but also our philosophical perspectives on the vastness and diversity of the cosmos?
Yeah, so there are two aspects to it. One is that, you know, we should be modest. Our imagination is much more limited than that of nature, and we should learn from nature. And the best way to learn from nature is to collect data and evidence and see what it tells us, not to assume that we know the answer in advance. And, you know, that is a good lesson for all of science. And unfortunately, many scientists have strong opinions and they do not seek evidence. And some of them work for their entire careers on concepts that represent past knowledge, without doubting it, because part of the motivation for them is to demonstrate that they are smart, not to really figure out nature. And to demonstrate that you are smart, you just need to do intellectual gymnastics, and it doesn't really matter. You know, you don't want to take any risks by exploring things that are not known to us. But the way I see it is more as a learning experience. Science is like a detective story. You're trying to learn something that you didn't know before. And obviously you take risks, and in the process of doing that, you might be wrong on occasion. You might think the clues lead you one way, and then when you collect more data, it turns out to be the other way. But as long as you are not doing it for your ego, as long as you're not trying to show that you're to show off, but you're trying to learn what nature is, all is good. You know, it's a thrilling experience. You learn something new. But if you really want to show off, you prefer not to take risks. And when something violates your prejudice, you would argue against it. You would say, you know, the data is wrong. We don't really know. There are all kinds of doubts. You will basically raise dust in the air such that you could claim that you don't see anything. And that's exactly what happened in my case when some people said, we don't believe the US government report, even though the US Space Command had professionals look back at the data and confirm it in an official letter to NASA. And then some of my colleagues wrote a scientific paper saying, even then, they do not believe the US government because it's just an official letter. They don't take into account the fact that there were professionals looking at the data within government to make sure that they, you know, that they're reliable. And this branch of government, the U.S. Space Command, is getting $40 billion a year, more than NASA, to alert the U.S. president for any incoming ballistic missiles. And they just cannot afford to be wrong. Nevertheless, astronomers on the day that I came back from the expedition published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal claiming that they don't believe the numbers in the data because they cannot fit those numbers with a model that they have for solar system stones. And I call that the stone age of science, when everything in the sky must be stones. I mean, it's a sense of arrogance to claim that you don't believe data just because your model doesn't fit it. I also knew that the material strength of this meteor was very high, but I didn't claim the data is wrong. I just said, let's find what it is. And indeed, if it comes from a molten magma ocean, you know, it's very likely that the material strength would be much higher because, you know, you concentrate very heavy elements and you first melt them together into a compound that could have a very high material strength, much more than you find in stone. So you should allow yourself to find something new. You can't claim data is wrong just because it doesn't fit your model for stones. And then the second part that I learned in this experience is that very often in life, you have to take risks and you have to be an optimist because life is self-fulfilling prophecy sometimes. And if you don't search, you will not find anything. And so in this particular expedition, all the stars were aligned. Everything went well, but it was a very risky experimental project. First, I could have not raised the funds. It was $1.5 million. And, you know, a very wealthy individual contributed that. And then it could have been that I wouldn't bring on board the best engineers that would design instruments that work. And they did, they delivered, and the instruments worked. And then we might have not found anything from the meteor because it wasn't big enough to release enough particles for us to find something. But we did. And then the experimentalists that look into the composition, they could have been busy and they could have said, we don't have time to help you. But it all worked out. And you know, it's really important to not be swayed because a lot of people were telling me I will not find anything. When I went there, they said there is nothing for you to find and it's impossible across such a big region to find anything. When I came back, they said that they don't believe the US government, even though I had the materials already. And now when we analyze it, there were two reports by scientists who said that they believe we found coal ash, very common substance that you get from fires, for example, coal ash. And we looked at 55 elements and demonstrated beyond any reasonable doubt that it's not coal ash. So why would these scientists that have no access to the materials bring up all this negativity? I think some of them are driven by the desire to step on every flower that rises above the grass level. They just get annoyed that someone else is doing interesting work. And, you know, it goes against curiosity. If you are really curious about this object, let other people, you know, nobody's asking you to do any work. You're just sitting on your chair. So why spew out negativity? You can just wait and see what those people come up with, and then you can ask questions about it. That would be the constructive approach. But instead, there were these people who steadily made negative remarks and attacked personally those people who are actually doing the work, you know. And it was a huge amount of work. It took us a year to plan this, 2 weeks to be in the ocean. I didn't sleep much because we had to wake up in the middle of the night to collect the materials. Then we bring it back. We work on it for 8 months. But still, some people find it really necessary for them to somehow derail that investigation. And it's really unfortunate. And they were also people like bloggers who would make negative comments. And they call themselves astrophysicists. If you look at their record, they don't have even a single publication over the past decade. So they are not really practicing scientists. And they resemble commentators looking at a soccer match and telling the players how to pass the ball. How dare they? You know, they are not really doing any science. And they pretend to be the representatives that protect science. I would call them anti-science advocates because they're going against the scientific method, which is all about collecting evidence and data, analyzing it, and publishing it in peer-reviewed journals. So you find all of this, and you know, then you ask yourself, you know, is it really true that those people who claim to represent science, to protect science, are they really anti-science? Which is really strange, you know, like they're doing exactly the opposite of what they're pretending to be. And so I had these experiences, and I prefer to take the approach of the eagle. You know, the eagle sometimes has a crow on its back that pecks at its neck. And so the eagle, instead of fighting the crow off, goes to greater heights where the oxygen level is low. And then the crow drops off the back of the eagle because it cannot stay there. And so for me, the best approach is to do the science to the best of my ability, so that those critics who peck on my neck will drop off. They would have nothing to say.
Yeah. I have so many more questions, but I want to clear the stage for Brandon here. I think
it's just outstanding, Professor. I do have just something to say here, and then before my question, then my question. Now, I'd like to expand your curiosity as we were talking about here and for all of us. Now, I've heard several talks that you've had. You're all over the place. You're fantastic. I actually had my first year doing a podcast. We had like 50 episodes. It's nowhere anymore. It's absolutely deleted. We did a whole episode on you and Oumuamua. And it was so, this is a really cool thing for me to sit here and to be able to have this conversation. So to that point, I heard you in a recent talk. And to this, I'd like to explore the things not known to us that you just talked about earlier. So You say that you often tell young scientists never pretend to be the adult in the room. And I love this. I thought that this was so fantastic because obviously it's a metaphor for keeping your childlike wonder. Now, to that, I firmly believe that you have two people to impress in this world, your 5-year-old version of you and your 85-year-old version of you, right? And sure. So that 5-year-old smile that you just gave us there, I would like to give permission to just absolutely have some fun with this here, okay? And not to say I'm a professor at Harvard and we've got to stick to rigid. Let's explore the curiosity. Let's soar to some new heights. Let the crows fall off, okay? Loved your metaphor, by the way. Okay, when we talk about meteors and comets coming in from other outer space, right, and they may be bringing we don't know what with them. Now, one of the universal conduits for us that we have found important for life is water, right? Now, meteors and comets also, comets especially, contain water. Now, who's to say that that water isn't coming from an outside source that has some sort of alien DNA, some sort of alteration to our human DNA that then just infects, for a better sense of the word, these extremophiles, perhaps even parasites, that then could literally alter the consciousness of humanity, perhaps even tapping you on the shoulder from within to say, hey, Loeb, check out this Oumuamua thing. It might be a thread you want to pull on here. And maybe this is an inner working with extraterrestrial and us on a cellular level, probably brought from the cosmos on these beautiful rocks that glide through our skies, crash into our oceans, and maybe bring us a gift in these forms. And perhaps that's why comets were heralded throughout ancient times, because they signaled great change in humanity on many levels, right? So what are your thoughts on that? That actually the aliens, if you will, are here with us in the form of DNA that we constantly get upgraded in comet strikes on Earth carrying ancient water.
Yeah, it's quite possible. This process is called panspermia, where life and influence can be brought or communicated between planets and different environments. And we know, for example, that Earth and the Mars exchange rocks throughout their history. And in 1980, there was a rock that was analyzed, and it became clear that it wasn't heated by more than 40 degrees Celsius from the time it was launched from Mars and arrived at Earth. And that allows tiny astronauts like microbes to survive on such a rock. And so this process of transfer of life and influence on life at a distant location is definitely possible and relevant, and also exchange between stars. Yeah, so interstellar objects could definitely affect what happens on Earth. And you know, it's possible that we are all Martians, that life started on Mars and arrived here. One curious thing I would like to do, if I have the funding or the chance to do it, is to go into the caves, those lava tubes that are on Mars, because Mars lost its atmosphere about 2 billion years ago, when it was at the middle of its lifespan. And if intelligent life developed on Mars twice as fast as it did on Earth, then it could have had some intelligence before it lost its atmosphere and before it lost its liquid water on the surface. And so what I would like to do is go into those caves and check if there are any prehistoric paintings on the cave walls of Mars. That would be very interesting. Of course, NASA would like to know if there were any microbes on early Mars. I would like to extend that to intelligent life as well. But to answer your question, definitely, you know, we are connected to the cosmos. We receive a lot of materials from it. And there is a possibility, especially if something technological arrives and it has a purpose, it could definitely change things for us. And, you know, humans came to exist only a few million years ago. That's at the end of the history of Earth. And the question is, why did it happen? There is also a period about 200 million years ago where there was a global warming of the Earth. We think that we are now triggering global warming, but the climate featured all the symptoms of global warming about 200 million years ago. And that was at the end of a period of when life blossomed on Earth. And an interesting question is whether we are the first. Are we the first intelligent species to exist on Earth, or was there something that triggered the global warming before us on Earth? And, you know, 200 million years is just 6% of the age of the Earth. So it's just, again, towards the end of its lifespan. It's quite possible that we were not the first. I mean, humans were not the first. So even here on Earth, you know, we believe that we are the most intelligent that exists right now, the species that is privileged to be in that state. And that's why we serve in restaurants on the menu less intelligent species for us to eat. And you know, if we ever encounter aliens that are as intelligent or more intelligent than we are, I would never dare to put them in my soup. We are actually receiving a dose of modesty from the possibility that our technological products, artificial intelligence systems, very soon might supersede our intelligence. Imagine ChatGPT 5 that might have more connections than the number of synapses in the human brain. It would be a more complex entity than the human brain. And I would feel really bad taking it out of the electric power outlet, because it would be equivalent to pulling the trigger on a person. And that will be the first awakening that will tell us we are probably by that time not the most intelligent entity on Earth, because there are these AI systems that can do better than we can. And many people will deny it and argue that they are not there yet, but eventually it will happen, maybe a decade from now, maybe a little more. But it's clear to me that we are heading in that direction. This is just the beginning of our bigger awakening that, in fact, there may be a neighbor out there, a cosmic neighbor, that is far more intelligent than we are. And for me, it's not so much, again, a battle, a conflict with our ego, because I gave up a long time ago on us being the most important thing in the universe. You know, I do believe that, you know, since there are hundreds of billions of Earth, Sun systems in the Milky Way galaxy alone, and then trillions of galaxies in the universe, I gave up on the possibility that we are the most intelligent that ever existed since the Big Bang, that Albert Einstein was the smartest scientist for 13.8 billion years, that Elon Musk was the most successful entrepreneur. I think it's very likely there are much more successful entrepreneurs out there. And if Elon, you know, he put his Tesla Roadster or as a dummy payload on the Falcon Heavy in the test launch of February 2018. So now this Tesla is orbiting the sun on an elliptic orbit. Eventually it may crash on Earth within 100 million years. It's quite possible there are lots of space trash objects out there that collide with Earth. And of course, the astronomers would argue it's a rock of a type that we've never seen before, or the data is wrong because we cannot fit it with a stone. But my point is, we should have the humility, given that we are trashing space with objects that will not be functional in the long term and may exit the solar system. We should be humble enough to acknowledge the possibility that some of the objects entering the solar system from outside are technological in origin. And of course, finding, you know, a tennis ball from a neighbor would convince us that the neighbor exists, and may also teach us about the habits of the neighbor. The neighbor might play tennis, you know. And, you know, if we were to find a tennis ball coming from interstellar space, I'm sure there would be scientific papers arguing, yeah, it looks as if the neighbor plays tennis, but in fact, it may be something else that it represents. And there would be conferences of scientists debating one way or another, does the neighbor play tennis or not, and so forth. And but it's really, it will be a shock to humanity to realize there might be a neighbor that is more advanced than we are, and we can learn from it. And I'm already there. You know, for me, it's really important to search, because if you don't search, if you don't seek the evidence, you will never find it. And, you know, Elon Musk a month ago gave a speech on Starship in 2024. And he said, I haven't seen any evidence for aliens. And on that, I say, well, you know, evidence or new knowledge does not fall into our lap. We invested $10 billion in the Large Hadron Collider to find the Higgs boson. We invested $10 billion in the Webb telescope to find the first stars and galaxies. You know, you really need to put a lot of effort in order to find something new. You can't just say, I don't see the Higgs boson, therefore I, you know, it may not exist. This is not the right approach. It's just like a single person staying at home and saying, I don't see any partner around me, therefore I don't have any partner. Well, we all know that to find a partner, you need to go to dating sites. You need to put some work into this. You can't just expect things to happen to you. And so that's exactly the mentality that was adopted, starting with Enrico Fermi, you know, who said, where is everybody? And then, you know, that is a very presumptuous statement for someone having lunch in Los Alamos. Why would they come to your lunch table in Los Alamos in 1950? You know, the universe has a history that is measured in billions of years, and the distances are, you know, thousands of light years, and the chance of them being exactly where you are when you are looking for them is really small. You have to put effort into that. And so that, I think, is really the mistake made by many people that are not seeking the evidence. And, you know, only over the past decade, we found the first interstellar objects. And two of them, two out of three, looked really weird. This meteor that I described and Oumuamua. And to me, it's a wake-up call. It basically says, let's check our neighborhood. You know, Oumuamua was the size of a football field. We couldn't see anything smaller than that from the reflection of sunlight. There might be many more. We never launched a spacecraft as big as as a football field. So I think, you know, we're just starting to be aware, become aware that unusual objects come from interstellar space. And for me, it's very exciting to figure them out. And as you said, I look at it from the point of view of a kid, you know, not assuming that we know the answer in advance, not trying to show off, just trying to find those things.
Yeah, because that five-year-old version of you is having a blast with these ideas and is so proud of you for the work that you've done and showing other actual five-year-olds here in their time that there's something to be revered in the sky that also may be connected to something fascinating and amazing, and you're not rubbing that aside, you know, you're not brushing that off, which is beautiful. This is why you stand out in your colleagues. And I don't know if you know this, but the origin of your name, Abraham, I mean, do you know Abraham's significance in the Bible?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, so I should say the name came from my grandfather, who was born in Germany for many generations. Albert, that was his name, and that's equivalent to Abraham. And of course, yeah, in the Old Testament, obviously that name has significance. Yeah.
What I find most fascinating about it is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, as you said earlier, even woven through your ancestry, you know.
Right.
So to
right.
this would be that God, you know, called him to leave his father of terra, right, which is terra firma, perhaps. Now, this is purely metaphor with this, which is fascinating. So he was called to leave the house of his father terra and settle in the in Cana, which is the promised land, right, for his progeny. Now, God's promise to that was, I will give you land for your descendants. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. So you, Abraham Loeb, left the father Terah, the established community that said, no, you can't think like this. And you offered that five-year-old version of you, which offered all of us the opportunity to stake our numbers in the stars here. Again, it's all very interesting. That's based
well,
on your name.
I should tell you, in 2 days, I will be 62 years old. I calculated that I started my career in astrophysics about 40 years ago. Okay. And for 40 years, I've been doing mostly theoretical work, basically drinking from the fire hose of ideas
and that wandering through the desert.
Constantly come up in my mind. But over the past 6 years or so, since Oumuamua was discovered, I decided to lead experimental work. The hope is that in this final act of my career, I will get to the promised land, just the way the Israelites, you know, it took them 40 years to go through the desert before they got into the promised land. So there is this coincidence that there is a chance maybe that I will get to the promised land in the near future. And, you know, one reason that I'm optimistic is when you take a path that other people did not take, then there is a chance that you will find some low-hanging fruit. And that's what we are doing with the Galileo project that I'm leading. And now we are planning to go on an expedition to the second interstellar meteor. I should say the U.S. government was always supportive of what I'm doing. And the U.S. Space Command provided us with data about this first meteor, despite the ridicule and the pushback from astronomers, you know, and you would, if you think about it, the U.S. government is a very, you know, the U.S. Space Command, very serious organization. That's not part of their day job to help science move forward. But it's this irony that they are willing to provide data that is otherwise classified for us to advance our knowledge of interstellar space. And it's the scientific community, the conservative astronomers who worked on rocks and stones for years, who are resisting that knowledge and saying, no, we don't want your data. We think that you are wrong and there is nothing to be found, instead of being curious about it and trying to figure out what it means.
Well, there may be something to it, very powerful.
I should also say that this applies to the unidentified anomalous phenomena as well, because the director of national intelligence, you know, again, an organization that receives a huge amount of funding, is important for national security, comes out with three reports about objects they cannot figure out. What would the scientists do? The natural thing is to say, I'm curious to figure out what these objects are. But no, the scientific community is not attending to that. And that's why the Galileo Project built an observatory that is collecting data as we speak at Harvard University, We looked at more than, you know, several hundred thousand objects, and we are analyzing it with machine learning, trying to see if there are any objects that are not birds, drones, balloons, airplanes. We are using machine learning software for that. And, you know, so this shows that, you know, we are curious enough to try and help the government and address a question that the public cares a lot about it. Rather than, you know, work for 50 years on extra dimensions, holography, concepts that have no bearing on our daily life and no experimental verification, the way that most of the theoretical physics community did over the past decades. And, you know, to me, it sounds like common sense that one should attend to unusual, anomalous data. But common sense is not common. And I should say that there is the Munich Security Conference that took place just a few days, I mean, a week ago in Munich. And the organizers this year decided that for the first time to have science featured. It's usually a very high level political event where heads of state and prominent officials participate, negotiate, discuss things, present things. So I was invited to that first time science discussion, and it was about space. And I had a 45-minute session that is on video. You can find the link for that on my medium.com website, where I put the essays that there. In one of them, I put the link to that. And so it was really an unusual conference for me to attend a week ago, because we went to have some drinks on the roof of that conference site, and then there were snipers there with black covers on their head, and I've never been to a conference in my career with snipers on the roof. Obviously, they were not there to protect me. They were protecting Kamala Harris and Volodymyr Zelensky, who were on the same day speaking. That was one interesting experience. And then a couple of days later, I was invited to give the keynote lecture in Poland, Torun, the place where Nicolaus Copernicus was born. And the Polish government decided to celebrate 550 years to the birth of Nicolaus Copernicus, who discovered that, you know, we are not at the physical center of the universe. The interesting story here is that he was a priest, Copernicus, and he wanted to satisfy the interest of the church. And the church had a problem at that time. They could not forecast the time of Easter, and it was very important for them. And they were using the theory of epicycles, the Ptolemaic model for the motion of planets, where the Earth was at the center. And they would get it wrong by a few days. They just couldn't get Easter predicted correctly. So they were upset about it. They said, what the hell is going on? We are using the best model and we don't get it right. And then Copernicus said, okay, well, let me figure out a better model. He was brilliant. And he realized that if you put the sun in the middle instead of the Earth in the middle, everything falls into place. And so he proposed this model. Now, the church didn't like it because the Earth was not at the center, but they said, the model works. We will use the model. No worries. It will give us Easter. So they were very happy. But they said, nevertheless, it's a theoretical model. And so it has nothing to say about reality. The Earth is still at the center. It's just an effective theory that allows us to calculate Easter better. And because of that, Copernicus throughout his life hesitated, never published his book about it. And only and he had a collaborator, a young collaborator, and only at the end of his life, when he had a stroke, on his deathbed, he was presented with a published version of his book. And the church banned the book. They made it a forbidden book until the 19th century. And it's really ironic because today you say, well, if someone proposes a theory and it agrees with data, that makes the theory believed, believable. It becomes part of the truth that the science believes in. But back then they said, no, it's just a theory. It doesn't apply to reality. And of course, now the church admits, I mean, 30 years ago, they decided to accept the concept that the sun is in the middle of the solar system. So anyway, this was the Copernican revolution. And I was asked to give a talk and I spoke about the next Copernican revolution, which is to find that we are not at the intellectual center of the universe, that in fact, there might be intelligence out there, a neighbor that is better than us. And of course, many of my colleagues still argue that this is an extraordinary claim and it needs extraordinary evidence. I think the other way around. I think claiming that we are at the intellectual center of the universe is an extraordinary claim. It's very arrogant. And for that, you need extraordinary. But these people are not seeking any evidence. And of course, if you're not looking for evidence, it's just like the church. You're not trying to check if your set of beliefs is correct or not. These were two events, the Munich Security Conference and this keynote lecture in Poland, that they really were very symbolic, I should say. At the end of the event, I was given in Poland, I was given the Book of Copernicus, which you can see on my side here, a copy of the book in a leather binding from the governor of Torun in Poland. So I really felt very honored to be there at that celebration.
So we're running out of time here, and therefore I have only one question left. Since we were talking about our five-year-old selves, I know because I had 4 5-year-olds here myself at one point in time, and I'm glad these little bed bugs are grown up now, but 5-year-olds sometimes get angry. So my question is, how often do you think about Oumuamua still and the possibilities that its exploration would have offered? Are you angry sometimes that you didn't have enough time to explore it?
No, I think in life you need to move on, okay? Because suppose you go to a bar and you sit there and suddenly you see an amazing person that you wanted to converse with, and that by the time you approach that person left already, and there is no way to find that person. I mean, that's pretty much the experience with Oumuamua. Instead of agonizing and obsessing with a bad experience that you didn't manage to learn more about that person, a better approach is to look for similar people, you know, like maybe someone else will come along, you know, just be optimistic. And in 2025, there would be a new telescope that will survey the southern sky. It's called the Rubin Observatory in Chile. It will have a 3.2 billion pixel camera. And together with my postdocs, we designed a pipeline, a computer software that would allow us to find objects like Oumuamua and discover them early enough so that people can then look at them more carefully. And so that's my hope, that starting in 2025, we'll find maybe one Oumuamua every month or every few months. And instead of obsessing with the one that we had in 2017, you know, my hope is to bring many more to our attention. And because it's unlikely that it was a one-time event, you know, it's probably the case that more of these objects are around and we just need to keep looking.
Awesome.
Fascinating.
So, yeah. I think we're at the end. I have so many more questions, but...
Well, you can still ask one more if you want.
I think...
I've got one. All right. So let's say Oumuamua spins back around and lands on the Harvard yard. You happen to be outside eating lunch on a beautiful day. And they said, you know what? We went by Robert Wierick's place. He said he's not interested, the discoverer of Oumuamua in 2017, for those listening. And let's say that he passed on the opportunity, but it lands in front of you. It's this beautiful, amazing thing. Entities walk out and they say, you know what? Because of your work and being so cool about us, we'd like to take you on a trip of the universe. We'll tell you all of the secrets, but the trick is you can't come back. Would you go?
Definitely. In fact, even if they offer me to come back, I would not.
Wow.
I'm very, I'm optimistic. I'm very disappointed by what is happening right now on Earth. You know, there's two wars going on. We're investing $2 trillion a year in military budgets. And if we were to allocate that money to space exploration, we could launch a probe towards every star in the Milky Way galaxy within one century. It's just a question of priorities. But I'm not naive like John Lennon. You know, I don't believe that the way he said it, imagine all the people living in peace. You know, I just cannot imagine that. I do think that we deserve a shock therapy, that if there is a visit or a package that we find in our mailbox that implies that we have a more intelligent neighbor next to us, that will give a shock to humanity. And of the type that Copernicus delivered, you know, when he argued that the Earth is not at the center. And that could change our priorities, I hope, for the better. A lot of people are worried about the threat, are worried that humans will go, you know, that society will break down. I don't think so. The way I see it is more like the arrival of the Messiah, except the Messiah will not come from Earth. It will come from another star. And it will change our priorities because it's just like finding a smarter student in the class. You know, that even though it's a blow to your ego, you realize that you can do better and you can learn from that student. And that's the way I see it. And if I'm offered to go up, I think I will do it optimistically and not come back. You know, because there is so much real estate out there. I'm really curious to see what's out there. My wife says that if I go, she wants me to do two things. First, make sure that I leave the car keys with her, not take them with me. And second, to ask them not to ruin the loan in the front of our house when they lift off. She actually said that she will join me more recently rather than stay behind. And I see that as a sign of a good marriage.
Fair enough.
Yeah, so it's beautiful.
Your answer inspired me. I have one more question too.
Okay, go ahead.
And I want to refer to you to the article you sent me in the email when we had our conversation for the podcast. So how do you navigate the stark contrast between the open-minded, discovery-driven nature of scientific exploration and the often pragmatic, reality-based approach of politics?
Yeah, I mean, first I should say that every person that I meet has in them a childhood curiosity. You know, it's unfortunate that very often on social media or in academia that childlike bullying is more prevalent than childlike curiosity. But I think that every person has it in them. Okay, and that includes people in government. So, for example, in December I was visiting the U.S. Congress, and the person who hosted the visit comes out, and I've never met that person. He says, "I never believed that I would meet you because I keep following what you're doing." This is a very prominent person, you know, that gave me a glimpse at the childhood curiosity that person has, that a high-level political figure is really excited and inspired by what I'm doing as a scientist, driven by curiosity. So I think, you know, this is a subject that can unify across political parties, can unify people from different nations. I see it as a unifier. That because all of us are curious to know if there is someone else out there. And the other thing is, if it's out there, you know, it's not nothing to do with a particular nation, with the way we split the land on this rock that we live on near the sun. So I think it will bring people together. That's the way I see it. Or at least for now, I see politicians as, you know, they are supportive and helpful and trying to encourage me to do what I'm doing. You know, to me it was surprising, but that's the reality. So So that's the way I get the attention. And also, of course, I was interacting with Washington, D.C. before I started being interested in this subject. But I should say that it's all positive so far. All the conversations I had with high-level politicians were supportive, and which is interesting because the only negativity I get is from some jealous individuals that are pretending to represent academia or just worked on stones for decades.
Awesome.
It's like you're the updated Reagan's UN address from 89 that talked about a universal threat coming from outside, but you're not phrasing it as a threat. It's almost like a rebranding of the opportunity that it brings to unite rather than us uniting over a threat. It's beautiful.
Exactly, exactly. And it's not only Reagan, it's also Stephen Hawking that a decade ago said that we should be worried about the threat. But the point is that, you know, if they arrive at our doorstep before we arrive at their doorstep, they're far more advanced than we are. So it's just like a biker passing on the street and looking at the ants in the cracks on the pavement. You know, they don't pose a threat. I mean, if we are much less developed technologically, you know, we are just a curiosity. And the journey started long before we came to exist, because it takes, you know, many millions of years to traverse the distances between stars, you know. And so we just came to exist after they started the journey. They didn't have us in mind. So it's an opportunity for us to learn about them. Even if it's space trash, you know, their trash is our treasure.
Yeah. You know, when I was very young, I was a bad boy. I burned ants with my magnifying glasses, you know. I'm a little bit afraid though, so.
Well, okay, so here is my hope, that if they think of us as less intelligent, they will not eat us, they will not put us on the menus of their restaurants. That's my hope.
Yeah, mine too.
Same.
Okay.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. It was awesome. I had a lot of fun today. Thank you so much for that.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Is there anything that you want to promote before we leave?
Oh, one thing is, we are starting to plan the next expedition to look for the second interstellar meteor. If there is anyone interested in helping to fund this expedition, it will cost $5 million. They should get in touch with me. And second, I post essays on medium.com. If you just search for Avi Loeb at medium.com, you can find my essays every day or two or three, and they are offered for free. You can have free subscription there. So these are the two things that I wanted to highlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I subscribed, and your articles are awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Brandon, you want to wrap it up for us?
This is outstanding. Professor, thank you so much for your time, honestly. This is a wonderful dive into the insights that you have with this, and just to be able to explore a little further and knock some crows off the back, because I can't handle that. I love that, man. What a wonderful metaphor. I'll definitely be using that in the future. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.